Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for coming. It's great to see everybody. If I could just ask you to turn off your phones, please, that would be very kind. It's good to start on time. That's excellent. So I don't like to take away from our Goldscheider. But we do have a very full shiur. And as promised, I would like to look at a topic that I have not ever looked into before anywhere, and I've been promising this for a few years, which is in the run-up to Sigd, which is, of course, a festival of the Ethiopian Beta Yisrael, coming up at the end of Cheshvan. Normally, I'm away traveling at the end of Cheshvan, and this year I'm not. I will be traveling, please God, in December. Next week, I hope to be here to do part two of this year, and then the following 2 weeks, it'll be somebody else giving the shiur, and I'll be back, please God, after that. But I'd like to look in two parts at the issue of the Beta Yisrael. I'm not so familiar with the community. I've been to a few weddings. Our friends' children are married into the Ethiopian community in different ways, like Kibbutz Galiot in Israel. Everyone's marrying everyone, which is actually a beautiful thing. But I'm not really an expert on this issue. I would, however, refer you to some good resources. First of all, there's a Rav called Rav Menachem Waldman, who has been working with the Beta Yisrael and the Ethiopian community for decades. He's written extensively since the 1980s on this, and I've referred to some of his material. He's written in English, he's written in Hebrew. Closer to home, someone who you may know, I certainly know, is Rav Shimshon Nadel. Rabbi Shimshon Nadel has been many times to Ethiopia, and he knows the community well, and he has some very nice shiurim on this as well, which I would recommend. He spoke at the OU a few years ago. There's also a great book out there called From Sinai to Ethiopia by Rabbi Sharon Shalom. Rabbi Sharon Shalom went through the Gush Etzion yeshiva system. He obviously was born in Ethiopia. He came here as a young child. I actually bumped into him randomly in Boston in a snowstorm many years ago. And we both took shelter in a shul and made up a minyan. And I looked at him and I said, "Aren't you Rabbi Sharon Shalom?" And he said, "Wow, how do you know who I am in the middle of a snowstorm in Boston?" And we actually got to know each other a little bit and have stayed in contact a little bit. His book is extremely useful. And I'll be bringing more from that next week. I'll show you in a minute how I'm going to divide up the shiurim. There is also, his book was originally in Hebrew, obviously translated. There's also another important Talmud Chacham called Rav Mubrato Solomon, also went through the Gush Etzion Bet Midrash. And as I'll show you next week, Rabbi Solomon and Rabbi Shalom differ very fundamentally on how the Ethiopian system of tradition, practice, minhag, should interweave with halachic normative practice now that the community has almost entirely come to Israel. And we'll show you next week those two different approaches, give you some of the examples, how that manifests itself in different areas of halacha. It's absolutely fascinating, but we'll be doing that next week. Next week is more of a halachic analysis of some of the issues within the practice of the Ethiopian Jews. This week I want to look at history and look at the issue of the halachic status of the Ethiopian community in different parts of that in terms of their Jewish status, connection with the law of return, whether there's a need for a conversion process. This was very, very a very vocal debate in the 1970s, and then in the 1980s when Operation Moses and Operation Solomon, which I'm sure most people here will remember, brought tens of thousands of Ethiopians over to Israel, and these questions became very significant. Obviously, the halachic challenges are not the only challenges. There are lots of social, cultural, economic challenges. I'm not going to be speaking to those. But today we'll look a little bit at the history of the Beta Yisrael, maybe just a little bit of a nomenclature. There are two groups, roughly speaking, within the Ethiopian community. I'm sure there are very many more, but from this perspective, there are two. The vast majority of the community consider themselves the Beta Yisrael, the House of Israel. These are people who have been Jewish, certainly for multiple centuries, many centuries. They claim for millennia. We'll talk about that in a minute. And despite the attacks on them in Ethiopia, the missionizing attempts to convert them to Christianity, that community to a large degree resisted those attempts, even though we'll see it was extremely onerous and there was famine and enormous poverty, and they were trying to be persuaded to convert to Christianity. Those people were airlifted over to Israel, and many of them walked over the desert. We'll talk about that too, quite early on. And they consider themselves to have always been loyal to the Ethiopian Beit HaYisrael traditions. Then there's another group who are often called the Falashmura. The Falashmura are a group that really did, to a large degree, convert to Christianity. They lived for many generations as Christians through the 19th and 20th centuries. And then when the Beit HaYisrael were taken to Eretz Israel, the Falashmura generally moved to the big towns, to Addis Ababa, to Gondor, and they reconverted, quote-unquote, to Judaism. Did they need to reconvert? How does that work? We'll talk a little bit. And now they say, look, we also wish to be brought to Israel because we're also part of the Ethiopian community. And it gets a bit confusing because there are those who very much support this, and there are those in the original, if you like, majority Beit HaYisrael community that say, no, these people were apostates, they were heretics, they gave in to the missionary attempts, and these people should not be brought over to Israel because they're not part of our authentic community. And therefore you have this debate even within the Ethiopian community as to how that should work. Leaving aside another debate, which is, are there people who are opportunists who are trying to pretend to be part of that community, who are completely non-Jewish, who are trying to get out of Ethiopia to Israel? Is this an issue? Is this not an issue? Is that a small issue? Were there people even who were war criminals, rebels, who were trying to escape from Ethiopia? I brought you some sources in the notes, that articles you can read in the Jerusalem Post and other places. I'm not going to get so much into that, but it's important to understand those different groups. Let's have a look at the history. There are five or six, if you like, foundation legends of how the Beit HaYisrael came about, and we'll see some of these in the sources. Perhaps the earliest tradition in terms of chronology, there's an old Ethiopian, general Ethiopian tradition, not just the Jews, but the Christians of Ethiopia as well, that King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, when the Queen of Sheba, when Malkat Shva came up, and Sheba is somewhere down near Eritrea, Ethiopia, Axums, which is North Ethiopia, maybe Yemen. Don't forget, Ethiopia and Yemen are very close to each other, as the Saudi Arabia, if you like, at the bottom of Saudi Arabia, connects with the Horn of Africa. You get those two places close together. Anyway, the Queen of Sheba comes. I'll leave you to sing the Handel overture yourself about the arrival. And she, in Sefer Malachim, in Sefer Divrei Hayamim, she meets Shlomo HaMelech. She gives him all these riddles, and he amazes her with his wisdom, and then she goes home. There is no hint anywhere in that story in Tanakh that they get married, let alone that they have a child. Although there is a slight hint, maybe. The Midrash picks up on the fact that it says there that the king, Shlomo HaMelech, gave the queen everything she desired. What else did he give her? So the Midrash says, well, what more could she possibly desire but to be one of his many, many wives? And of course, if she was a wife, she had a child. And this child, says the Ethiopian tradition, was Menelik. And Menelik became the first king of Ethiopia. And in fact, if you look in Ethiopia, and again, I've never been. I've been to some African countries. I've never been to Ethiopia. Now I've researched this. I'd love to go to Ethiopia. But many of the Ethiopian non-Jewish traditions trace their monarchs, Haile Selassie, remember Haile Selassie, back to the Solomonic line. And there's a lot of Shlomo HaMelech imagery all over Ethiopia. So the Jews say that, yes, when Shlomo HaMelech sent Menelik, who came to visit him, back to Ethiopia, he sent him with a big entourage of Jewish boys, the firstborn of many of his courtiers, and they became the Jewish community of Ethiopia. That's one approach. A more accepted Jewish approach we'll see, which we'll see in the sources soon as well, is that no, this group of the B'nai, of the Beit HaYisrael, they split from the Jewish people at the time of Yeravam, and at the time of the 10 tribes being exiled by Sancheriv. We'll see soon how they split from Yeravam, and they moved down to Ethiopia via North Africa, via Egypt, and they've been there ever since, and they are the tribe of Dan. And that they associate and identify as being the tribe of Dan that split off or was exiled by Sancheriv. A third view, and you can see Rabbi Shalom's book, you can look there at all the sources he brings, as no, actually the Beit HaYisrael are descended from Egyptian Jews. Egyptian Jews that lived in Egypt, there were for thousands of years Jews in Egypt, and many of them went south, and they ended up settling in Ethiopia. It's not so far, I mean, it's a few thousand miles, but it's not a crazy distance from Ethiopia to Egypt. And they actually settled there between the 7th century BCE, the 2nd century CE, and they were Jewish and they were Egyptian. Another tradition is that, no, they were Yemenites that came over. There were a lot of wars between Ethiopia and Yemen between the 2nd and the 6th century CE. And a load of Yemenite Jews ended up coming across. Did they come across? Were they brought across? Were they taken prisoner? And they were taken, as I say, that short distance to Ethiopia. And they came across and they formed the Ethiopian communities. If you ask the academics, and why you might say, am I interested in the academics? And you'll see, because Rav Herzog was interested in the academics. The academics will tell you, no, there is no evidence at all that these people were Jewish any earlier than the 13th, 14th century. Already from the 14th century, we have non-Jewish Ethiopian sources that talk about fighting people who were like Jews. You have those corroborating sources. The academics will say, yes, this community converted from the indigenous population, and they originally were non-Jews, and they're therefore converts. They converted to whatever Judaism they knew about, which was obviously not rabbinic Judaism, halakhic Judaism, and they've been living there ever since. And in fact, many people have done DNA studies on the Ethiopian Jews, and again, I'm not an expert in this, and other people might say, no, there are other studies that say differently, but the ones I've read about say that there is actually a lot of non-Jewish DNA in the Ethiopian Jewish community, and therefore maybe this academic account is relevant. We'll see in a minute why that's halachically relevant, because you'll turn around and say, ah, why do we care about the academics? It's not relevant at all. We'll see why this may in fact be relevant. But one thing is for sure, the Ethiopians for at least the last 900 years have been facing enormous challenges, persecutions, missionary activity, being attacked constantly by the non-Jews around them, who gave them the pejorative name Falasha. Falasha means a stranger, a wanderer, someone who's landless, and therefore they don't tend to use that name Falasha to describe themselves. I said this Falashmura is a subset. They use the name Beta Yisrael because Falasha was a derogatory name. It's funny, we have a lot of derogatory names that we've just adopted for ourselves. The word Orthodox is a derogatory word. It was used originally by non-religiously observant people to describe the narrow-minded, narrow-thinking, which is what Orthodox means, and yet we somehow have adopted that word and we're fine with it. So these things happen. Even the word frum, by the way, was originally a negative word. It meant people who were falsely pious and wore their religion on their sleeves, etc., etc. But now we seem to be all happy to be frum. Maybe we've just given up on that, you know, getting past that. But anyway, the falasha seems to be a non-polite word, but it's used by many of the earlier poskim. We'll see that going through. Fine. Let's have a look at some of the sources. So let's start in the 9th century with Eldad Hadani. Now, I don't know how much you know about Eldad Hadani. I didn't know very much at all about Eldad Hadani. But Eldad Hadani was a real person. He was on the scene. He was a traveler. He was one of these kind of early Marco Polo types that come. Of course, Marco Polo wasn't Jewish, as far as I'm aware, but Eldad Hadani definitely was. He wandered around Africa. He went to the Moroccan communities. He was in Karawan and in Algeria and Tunisia. He claimed to be a descendant of the tribe of Dan and to belong to an independent Jewish state in East Africa. He said that state was inhabited by people from Dan, Asher, Gad, and Naphtali. He refers to all sorts of biblical precedents for that. And in fact, when Eldad Hadani came to North Africa, he met the people of Karawan. And this is part of his testimony that he gave. Look at number one. V'yesh lanu Kabbalah. We have a tradition. Ish mipi ish she'anachnu b'nei Dan hayinu. We were from the tribe of Dan. K'she'amad aleihem Yeravam ben Nevat. When Yeravam ben Nevat, the time of after Shlomo's death, he rose up. Shehichti et Yisrael, hechti et Yisrael. He made the Jewish people sin terribly. Ba'asa shnei egli zahav. He put the two golden calves up there to stop the people coming. V'nechlek hamalchus beis David, and he divided up the Jewish kingdom. The nikbasar shvatim, and all the tribes, the northern tribes, came together. Va'amru, and they said, Kumu. Let's fight against Shlomo's son Rechavam. Let's fight against Jerusalem. The Amru lo. He said, my ancestor said to them, Lama anachnu nilchamim erzacheinu? Why should we fight against our brothers? Ben Adoneinu, David HaMelech, Yisrael v'Yuda. Why would we fight against the king, the rightful king, the son of David? Chalila v'chalila. Now, obviously, he's saying this 2,000 years after these events, or 1,800 years, but this is his account. They were given eventually advice. They couldn't persuade the northern tribes not to join Yeravam. They were given the advice to leave, to go down to Mitzrayim. Not the way that we came out of Mitzrayim, because he anticipates you'll say, well, you're not allowed to go to Mitzrayim the way that we came out. He says, no, don't worry, we went a different way. We were headed down to Ethiopia. We got to Ethiopia. We found a great country there, and we went to settle there. The Laimanu Libnei Dan Lashevet Imahem, the people there didn't stop us from coming. Ki bechazaka lakchu et ha'aretz. Because the tribe of Dan were tough. We see the stories of the tribe of Dan in Sefer Shoftim, you know, as they went up and they took new territory in Eretz Israel as well. So they went down to Eretz Cush and they settled there. They didn't think he was Eretz Israel, but this was better than them being roped into a fight against Shlomo HaMelech. Or against Rechavam ben Shlomo, sorry. How reliable is Eldad Hagani? So actually this is very interesting. Some people say not reliable at all. If you look in the Ibn Ezra, and I brought you a source for this in Shemot, in Perek Bet, the Ibn Ezra quotes Eldad Hadani and says, you can't trust this guy. He's not reliable. It's fake news. He lists their other books as well. The Sefer Zerubbabel, which you may or may not know about. He gives a list there of things he thinks you can't rely on. Which is interesting, because the Ibn Ezra himself, while often criticizing the Karaites, if he finds a nice pshat from the Karaim, from the Karaites, he's happy to use that. But he says, Eldad Hadani, no way. However, other people do support him. And in fact, when Eldad Hadani went to Karwan, the people of Karwan heard what he had to say. And included in Eldad Hadani's account is all sorts of unusual halachot, which go against the Talmud Bavli. For example, he says in Shechita, when you shecht an animal, you have to point the head of the animal, a regular animal today, towards Yerushalayim. In order to shecht it. That's not in Shulchan Aruch, that's not part of the halachic system. Although, interestingly, the Ethiopian Beit Yisrael also did that. Okay? And the community in Karawan, raised with Rav Tzemach Gaon, who was the Gaon in Babylon, in Surah at the time, they said, who is this guy? And do we accept these contrary antinomian tendencies, these heterodox opinions against the Talmud Bavli? And actually, quite unexpectedly, maybe unexpectedly, the Gaon of Surah, Rav Tzemach Gaon, said, yes, it's fine. Not everybody has exactly the same traditions. There's the Bavli, there's Yerushalmi, and there's Eldad Hadani. He has his own, for the most part, they're halachically consonant with the Gemara. And he says, don't be so quick to throw him out, which is very interesting. If you're interested in looking at where this figures, look at the beginning of Masechet Chulin, where it talks about Shechita. If you look there in the Rosh, if you look there in the Mordechai, then they deal with all of these halachas of Eldad Hadani. And for the most part, they're quite accepting of his authenticity, even if we don't paskin like all of these halachas. So that's just a little bit on Eldad Hadani. I brought you an interesting article, which I read on when the Gaonim were and weren't accepting of other opinions. But anyway, that's Eldad Hadani. By the way, the other person who quotes Eldad Hadani, this is a bit of fascinating history, Rav Chizdai ibn Shaprut. Chizdai ibn Shaprut was one of the Jewish leaders of the Spanish community, not just Jewish community, but the Spanish general community, a very senior diplomat in Spain in, I think, the 10th century, 9th, 10th century. And he writes a letter. We have this letter. This is not myth. We have a letter he writes to the king of the Khazars. When he says, Mazel Tov, I heard you converted to Judaism. And in that letter, he quotes Eldad Hadani, amongst other people. So, just so you know, this was someone who was getting around. Other people also, a little bit later, Benjamin of Tudela reports having met people from Ethiopia with the Mosaic Kingdom lying on the other side of the river. Don't forget, there were always rumors and legends, people on the other side of the famous rivers, the Ten Lost Tribes, etc. 1438, Rabbi Eliyahu of Ferrara was a traveler from Italy. He went to Eretz Israel. He actually got a job as a machanech in Eretz Israel. I can identify that with a little bit. And he came in 1438 to get a job in Israel. He wrote a letter back to his family in Italy. Number two, Ukudumi lishe kadanti. I already think I've already told you before, lahodiachan, to let you know. Mashi sipeli bachor echad yudi. One young boy I met in Israel, aladot anshei mekomo, about people from his place. Shehem adunim la'atzman, they're independent. They're einam burushut acherim, and this is in the 1400s, they're not under other people's controls. Vivoiseihem uma gedola nikret chubash. And around them there's a big non-Jewish city or a town, country called Chobash. What's Chobash? Chobash is often pronounced Habash, and Habash is Abyssinia. Abyssinia is the northern part of, if anyone knows any 20th century Italian history, Abyssinia and Eritrea, anyway, whatever. He said there's these non-Jewish people. Umitnatsrim, Besheti Va'erev, and they are forcefully converted. They try to convert them with the crucifix, apneim, in their faces. And he said, I heard there's always a war with these non-Jews. But yesh lehem haTorah, but they have the Torah. Uperish aleh alpeh, and they have an oral law. Ve'ein lehem lo haTalmud, but they don't have the Talmud. Ve'lo haPoskim shelanu, they don't have our poskim. Ve'chikarti mimenu bekama mitzvos, and I tested, he said, this young boy. I checked out, what do you do about this? This is in the 1400s. And what did he find out? B'ksatam, with some mitzvahs, notim ledatenu, they follow what we do. Ubiktzatam notim ledat hakaraim, but in others they followed the Karaites. Now we'll see this is very important because the Ethiopian community, if you like, were associated by some of the earlier poskim with the Karaites, even though they had nothing to do with the Karaites. They never met any Karaites and they weren't part of that whole movement. They split off earlier, and even if they didn't, they never came across Karaites. And yet, because they didn't have a Gemara, many of the poskim saw things that they did and they interpreted the psukim in a similar way to the Karaites. They didn't have any fire in their homes on Shabbat, which is a classic Karaite issue, to the point that we've invented all of these, like cholent and who knows what, to make sure that we show to everybody that we're not Karaites. And here are these people who do what the Karaites do. So he was a bit concerned about this, but we'll see in a minute how we resolve that. V'yesh lehem Megillat Esther, they do have Megillat Esther in their Tanakh, aval lo Chanukah. But they don't have Chanukah. Why would they have Chanukah? Chanukah if it's true that they split, when they say they split, Chanukah was way later. So the Gilad Esther they have, although interestingly they didn't celebrate Purim. They celebrated the fast of Esther in Nisan, which is in, but they didn't celebrate Purim, which is very interesting. More about that next week. Rav Avadi Bar Tanura, famous for his commentary on the Mishnah, also met Ethiopians. Go to the top of page 3. Here's number 3. The Anira Iti, I have seen. By the way, Rav Avadi Bar Tanura went on a trip from Italy to Israel, and he writes extensive correspondence back to his father about what he saw on the road. He spent some time in Sicily, some very interesting things. I mentioned to you some time ago, I gave a shir about Pilegesh. You probably don't remember it, we've had so many shirim since then, and about premarital sexual relations, etc. What's this got to do with anything, you ask yourself? One of the things that Rav Avadi Bar Tanura points out, he says, I went to live in Palermo, in Sicily for a while. He said, and there were lots of young women that came to the chuppah quite visibly pregnant. And this was something that we didn't seem to be able to stop when I was living in Palermo. It was very interesting. What's of course more interesting is when whoever it was, Altscroll or Feldheim, I don't remember, published this letter as a letter for the ages. They of course censored that line out. No one ever got pregnant in Palermo before it was time. But he writes all sorts, no holds barred. He writes about different things that he encountered. Ani ra'iti shnei mehem, I met two of these boys, v'mitzrayim in Egypt, v'hem shchorim ma'at. He says, and this is very interesting, because they were dark, but they weren't like West African dark. They were shchorim ma'at. They were a bit darker than other people. Now, that's interesting because, of course, I'm not an expert in anthropology, but the Yemenites also, many of the Yemenites are quite dark, but obviously not African dark, but this says they were also dark. Avalok ibne kushim. He says, but I noticed at the time they did not look like regular Africans. V'lo yachlu lahavchin mehem, and it wasn't... You couldn't tell with them im hem shomrim torat akraim or torat arabanim. It wasn't clear whether they were keeping Karaite Torah or rabbinic Torah. Ki b'ktzat dvarim hayu nirim shomrim torat akraim. Some things they do look like Karaite things. Ubema she'amru shelo haya nimsa esh bebateihim biyom haShabbat. They have no fire on Shabbat. Ubeshar dvarim nirim shomrim torat arabanim. V'hem omrim she'ed mechasim shevet Dan. And they say they came from Shevet done. So we've seen these early accounts, 1400s. Through the 1800s, I mentioned here also Shlomo Molcho. Shlomo Molcho was a wild character in the 16th century. I'm not going to talk much about him, but he also talked about the Ethiopians. He, in the end, was burnt at the stake as a kind of quasi-false messiah. Was a very big influence on Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Shlomo Halevi Alkebetz. If you want to understand Lecha Dodi and what's going on there, you have to know about Shlomo Molcho. That's not for now. But in the 19th century, it was already apparent that there were a lot of people who considered themselves Jewish who were stuck. And this was not something that they just, you know, worked out in Operation Moses in 1984. In the 1800s already, this was an issue. Even before then, Menashe ben Israel, from Amsterdam, originally from Portugal, then from Amsterdam, who came to London to try and persuade Oliver Cromwell, who of course had killed the king, to let the Jews in. The Jews were officially barred from England. Okay? And he was obsessed almost with the 10 tribes and convinced that we needed to take Jews to the very edges of the earth, which then of course was England. Or they had just about discovered America. And he tried to persuade Oliver Cromwell to take in the Jews. Did Oliver Cromwell agree? No, he did not agree. Oliver Cromwell did not agree to taking the Jews. Why would he? But what happened, just as an aside, when Oliver Cromwell, when the Britain declared war on Spain, and then said to the Spanish community in London, we're confiscating all of your property because you're Spanish, you're enemy aliens, a whole bunch of them piped up and said, well, actually, we're converso Jews. We're not really Spanish at all. We hate the Spanish. They made us converse to Christianity, and we shouldn't be included in this anti-Spanish legislation. And then he saw his petach. He said, ah, okay, I'll let you stay, but you have to start up a finance organization and the bursa, etc., etc. And that's how the Spanish Portuguese community in London arrived. They never arrived. They were there all along under the radar, and they like came out, and then other people came to join them. Anyway, Menashe ben Israel was interested in this. But in the middle of the 19th century, Rav Shmuel David Lotzato, Shadal, was engaged in extensive research, his son mainly. Shadal also spoke about this. There were Ethiopians that arrived in Yerushalayim and spoke to the Beta Yisrael. At the same time, I brought you here 1859, the London Society for Promoting Christianity Amongst the Jews got going in Ethiopia, headed, of course, by a Jew, a convert to Christianity, Henry Aaron Stern, who wanted to target the Beta Yisrael. And as they started targeting them, so the British became more aware, the British Jewish community, Rabbi Nathan Marcus Adler set up an organization to try and save the Ethiopian Jews. But he ran into trouble because people said, well, no, they're Karaites. Why would we want to save them? We don't want the Karaites to be successful. And they had to overcome that kind of prejudice that they thought they may be Karaites. We'll get to that when we get there. They started a whole early Zionist movement. Many of them tried to walk in the 1800s to Eretz Israel, failed. Many, many died. And then others, Rav Hildesheimer, many of the German poskim got very involved. Rav Zvi Hirsch Karlischer, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. And you can look all these things up. They appealed to rescue the Ethiopians. They set up an organization in France, the Alliance Israélite Universelle. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that quite right. To try and rescue the Ethiopian Jews. The Malbim got involved. All the sort of headline names of late 19th century Judaism. He said there's a mitzvah mission to get them out. There was a devastating plague in the late 19th century. Killed two-thirds of the community. It was terrible, terrible, terrible. And that made it even more of an emergency to try and get people out. There was a call in 1908 by 44 chief rabbis, which were then drawn by Rav Kook. If you go over the page to buy page 4, Rav Kook issued a Kol Kaira in 1922. Look what he says. Kol Kaira l'kol acheinu b'nei Yisrael, the b'chol atar v'atar. I call on every Jew around the world. Hatzilu na'achim. Save our brothers, or save brothers, et achenu hafalashim. Come and save the Ethiopian Jews. Mikilyanu mitmiya. They're being destroyed and starving, and they're being assimilated and converted. Azruna la shiva leinu eleinu es achim adi yachim ha'eli. Bring back these brothers, these lost brothers to us. The loyim chashedid nisroim etachat shmei Hashem. No, don't let a whole tribe be walked out, rubbed out from the under the heavens. Hashiva lubatzchanet inachenu. Bring back to a refuge our wandering brothers. Hatsilu chamishim elef nefashot. Let's bring 50,000. Let's bring 50,000 over. Kedoshot mi Beit Yisrael from the house of Israel, Kiliyav, Hosifu, Bezer, Oz, Ve'omets, Lebinyan Amenu, and they can be part of the building of the Yishuv. He said there's 50,000 Jews waiting to get out of Ethiopia. This is 1922. Just think what we could do with those people around the new Yishuv. They can build, they can be part of the country, etc. Interesting. So again, this call to save the Ethiopians was really a very early call. Okay, when did things really get going? In 1973, we'll see soon, Rav Avadia Yosef made a landmark tshuva, where he basically said, these people are definitely Jewish, and there's no question that they should be brought immediately to Israel. Very quickly after that, the law of return was changed in order to include, don't forget Rav Yosef was the chief rabbi, the law of return was changed to bring them back in. Menachem Begin said in 1977 to the Mossad, bring me the Ethiopian Jews. And they got a small number out. And then they decided to bring them through the Sudan, and Jews began to walk to the Sudan. Again, you probably, some of you remember this. Thousands died. It's not a short journey from Ethiopia to the Sudan, and it's certainly not an easy journey. They managed to get 8,000 out over 5 years. And then they did Operation Brothers. The Mossad took over a Red Sea diving resort. There's a film, there's a movie, the Red Sea Diving Resort, which I haven't seen, but I've seen about it. They say rabbis only admit to seeing movies on planes. That's when they admit to seeing a movie. And it was not a plane that I ever saw. You can decide if you believe the rabbis or you don't believe them on that. But this film was all about how the Mossad took that over and used it as a cover. Operation Moses, in the 1980s, you may also remember, I remember this very distinctly, the terrible famine in the 1980s and the way that was covered and the millions that died in the broader community. Operation Moses brought 6,000 of the Jews out from Sudan. Then it stopped. It was very interesting how it stopped. One of the politicians leaked it to the press, and then as soon as the press got hold of it, the Arab world went crazy and told the Sudanese, you can't allow this to happen, because the Sudanese were Muslim as well, so the whole thing got shut down. And then George Bush got involved, the elder, H.W., and he instructed the American military to bring out more Ethiopian Jews. That was Operation Joshua. Then the chief rabbinate got involved, we'll see Rav Gorin soon, and said, no, I'm not sure these Jews are Jewish. We'll see how that works in a minute. And finally, Operation Solomon, in 1991, they airlifted 15,000 Jews in less than 48 hours. Okay, that's an amazing, amazing thing. If you're wondering why you can't get an LL flight to America right now, and yet they can bring 15,000 Jews in 48 hours, you can call LL and ask them what's going on. They weren't, well, they took all the seats out of the planes. If you're ever complaining that you don't have enough leg room, they took all the seats out of the planes and they put everybody in the planes and they brought them over. And this still remains even in 2021, 22, 23. You had Operation Tzu Yisrael, brought 5,000 Ethiopian Jews because of COVID. They didn't have access to medication. But now the Jews who are there, as I say, are these flash murids and more of a complicated arrangement. Are they the same community? Are they not? We talked about that before. Okay, fine. Three main questions, halachically. First of all, are these people Jewish? They certainly keep a life of adherence to Torah mitzvot. They were very, very insistent on that, against persecution over centuries. But their origins are obscure. We're not clear who exactly they are. So that's one question. Second question is, those Ethiopian Jews that definitely did convert to Christianity, many did, but then returned, do they need any kind of conversion process? What do we do with people who convert? Does it matter if they were forcibly converted? If they were voluntarily they converted? Do they require some kind of new conversion, a geirus, or maybe even a geirus lechumra? We'll see if that helps or doesn't help. And then we have a question about mamzerut, meaning, do we know if all of the Ethiopians adhered to the halachot? Well, we do know. They didn't have halachot of marriage and divorce. They had marriages and they had divorce. Not much divorce, Rav Waldman says, and there's certainly not as much as in the Western world, even then. But they didn't have a halachic system for either of those things. They recorded them, they wrote them down. Rav Waldman has pictures of shtarot, of different documents from marriage and divorce. But what we're worried about is that they may have been halachically married, but then if they separated, they may not be halachically divorced. Because it's much easier to be halachically married than halachically divorced. At the end of the day, if you live together as man and wife and everyone sees you're a unit, etc., etc., you can easily end up married, but it's not so easy to get divorced. You have a question?
How can do Rabbanim requirement of marriage cause a person to...
Well, you're assuming it's the Rabbanon. We'll get there. We'll see Rav Avadi Yosef. We'll see him coming up soon. And if there is a concern of Mamzerud, what do we do about it? So we'll deal with all of those things over the next 25 minutes, Be'ezrat Hashem, till 20 past 11, and we'll have some interesting insights, hopefully. This, of course, is still a controversial issue. You may remember in 2018, there was a very controversial account in the Barkan winery, where they had an Eid Haredis Hechsher, and they employed a number of fully observant Ethiopian Jewish men who were working in the winery, but these men had not necessarily had an extra conversion when they came to Israel, and the Eid Haredis said, no, sorry, these people are not Jewish, we don't give you a hechsher for the wine. They can't handle the wine in the processing. You have to move them into a different part of the factory. You don't have to fire them, but we can't give you a hechsher because they're not Jewish. And Barakan Winery capitulated, and that's a bit of a strong word, but they said, okay, fine. The famous word they used, they said, business is business. They said, we need to keep our hechsher. And there was an outcry. The president of Israel got involved. They're racist. It's disgraceful. It's outrageous, etc. Now, what's interesting is that actually the Eid Haredis, even though they probably didn't accept it, were following the academic approach on the Beit Yisrael. Meaning, according to the Jewish sources, they were for sure Jewish. The only people who say that they're not Jewish are the scholars that are sitting in the departments of anthropology, wherever it is. And interestingly, the Eid Haredis were the people who were actually taking that view. The secular establishment who was screaming that the Jews are racist, of course they're Jewish, they were following the sources that they, in other areas, say are complete nonsense, and they won't accept those sources. Of course, you can't trust all these medieval rabbinic Jewish sources. Well, they were the ones that said the people were Jewish. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy going on in all corners here. Because when it suits people, they do choose the things, then when it doesn't suit them, they don't choose the things. It's going to be very interesting, but this is still controversial. A few things before we get into the tshuvot. Number five, the first thing, on page five. So this is a Gemara which raises the question, I'm not going to learn this inside, how do I know that a non-Jew who gets married is not actually Jewish because they're descended from the 10 tribes? Who knows? The 10 tribes disappeared. Maybe your non-Jewish next-door neighbor is descended from the 10 tribes, and maybe he's really Jewish, or she's really Jewish. And the Gemara says, no, absolutely not. We have a chazakah, we presume. Nobody descended from the 10 tribes is considered Jewish at all. Okay, well, that already gives the Ethiopian Jews a bit of a hurdle, because they say, well, that's us, we're descended from the 10 tribes. So it's not so hard to really get over that, because the Gemara was talking about people who, for all intents and purposes, are non-Jews. They live as non-Jews. They don't have any connection with Judaism. The only question is, did they descend distantly from somebody? Whereas the Ethiopian Jews are living life as Jews. They're eating matzah, and they're doing all of the halachic things that they do within their system there. They have a shul, they daven, etc. And therefore, it's not so difficult to get over that Gemara, because it may not apply in the same way to those Jews. And then we have another account, question is, if somebody converts to Christianity, do they need to reconvert when they come back? Look at number six for a second. This is quite famous. Gemara, Chata Yisrael, when Achan steals from the booty of the Jericho, of Jericho. So God says to Yeshua, Chata Yisrael, the Jews have sinned. All the Jews, because there's collective responsibility, even though only one person did it. Amar Rabbi Amar Razavda, Afal Pishe Chata Yisrael, who... It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter how bad it gets. It doesn't matter what you convert to. You're always a Jew. If you're born a Jew, you're always a Jew. And this actually is the psak of the Shulchan Aruch, number 7. Yisrael Momo Shekidesh. If an apostate Jew contracts a marriage, Kedushah Kedushin. His marriage is a good marriage. Kedushin Gemorin. It's completely a marriage. Utsricha Mimenu Get. They are totally Jewishly married, even though they're completely apostate. He's an apostate. She's an apostate. They're still married. V'afilu Zaru Shehoyed Mishehemi. Even children they have later who were brought up completely as Christians or Muslims. In Kiddush Oisazera. If that child then gets married, Yisrael, to a Jewish woman, Kedushah Kedushin. Meaning you can't become not Jewish. There's nothing you can do to get rid of your Jewishness. Of course, v'davka sheoli miyisraelit afilu mumeres. That's only if the father married a Jew, a Jewess. Aval im holi demina akum. Of course, if he married a non-Jewish woman, then the child is not Jewish because the mother is not Jewish, even if the father was religiously observant. We don't care. Meaning, he says, we're only interested in whether the mother was halachically Jewish. And we're not interested in what you believe, what you do, what you keep, what religion you are. You could be the Pope. And you could be Jewish. Probably have been Jewish popes. The question is, what do you do about it when you come back? So number 8 says the Ramah, Yisrael muma she'asa tshuva. If an apostate Jew decided to return, eino tzarech litbol. They don't need to do a new tefillah. They don't need to reconvert. Rak midrabbanan yesh lo litbol ulekabel alav divrei chaveiros. But they do, there is like a minag, a strong, he says, derabbanan, it's like origins of minag, they should go to the mikveh to kind of rededicate. That they're now part of the Jewish people once again. Divrei chaveiros. Bifnei gimel, it's a kind of mikveh conversion, but not a real one. Okay, so what is this? Like a geirus lechumra? Not really. I'm Jewish, but I'm now reconnecting with the Jewish people. So do we want the Ethiopians to do that? Or is that just insulting? Because they were always connected with the Jewish people. They just didn't keep Shabbos the way you and I keep Shabbos. How does this work, etc.? And therefore, we're going to have to answer all of these questions. At the bottom of page 5, I put you a halacha about the Karaites. The Ramah says we do not accept the Karaites because we think they're all Safik Mamzerim. And there's this issue again. Safik Mamzerim, we think their weddings were weddings, but their divorces were not divorces. And we can't trust the Karaites. And therefore, even if they want to become Jewish, they can't because they're already Jewish and they're Safik Mamzerim. They're stuck. Because if you're Jewish, which the Karaites were, but you're a Safik Mamzer, like a real Safik, we'll see in a minute where a Safik Mamzer is a Mamzer, then what can you do about it? If you're not Jewish, it's actually a lot easier. Because you're kind of a non-Jewish Mamzer, because you convert and then everything's clean, all good to go. Okay, you can't marry Kohen Shkayach. It's a lot easier than being a Safik Mamzer. And therefore, how are we going to apply this to the community? Let's go. Rav David Ibn Zimra. Rav David Ibn Zimra was Egyptian living in the 16th century. Sorry, 15th century. 15th, 16th century. And he says he has a few tshuvot about the Ethiopian Jews. Very tragic cases. One case was a tshuva about a man who acquired a slave, a Jewish woman who was a slave with children. And then she told him he was Jewish. She was Jewish. She told him she was from the Beit Yisrael and she was married and she had children, but her husband had been killed by marauders and bandits and she'd been taken hostage. So the man said, Oive, what are we going to do with this woman? And he treated her as an aguna, which was very noble, that she says she's Jewish, and she's a husband. Who knows if her husband's really dead? But, you know, over the time that they were together, one thing led to another, and they ended up having a child with each other. And then the question was, this child grew up, and the question is this child really a mamzer? His mother was a slave who was captured, and she said her husband died, another. That was one issue, on which the Radvaz seems pretty clear that he felt that the Ethiopian Jews were maybe Karaites, but we'll see in a minute the second tshuva. Number 11. So look at this, the second tshuva. Sheila she'alta mimeni. Odiyachadati b'mishe kana eved chofshi. Someone who, again, the slave trade was very broad, they were very widely engaged in. Someone bought a slave, eved chofshi me'oisa yudim hadarim be'eretz kush. And they turn out to be an Ethiopian Jew. Echid ne'egimo. How do you have to relate to that slave, quote-unquote, that you bought? Im yotze b'sheish, do they go free like an Eved Ivri in the 6th year? Or lo, do they not go free? Do I treat this person like a slave? Look what he says. Hilkach, in number 11, tshuva. Hilkach, ze shekana ha'eved achoshi, if you acquire an Ethiopian Jew as a slave, keivan shenidbara lo shehu yudi, as soon as you realize that they're an Ethiopian Jew, that they're Jewish, ein ze ela pidyon shvuim. He said, Yashakoach gadol, you just did a wonderful mitzvah of pidyon shvuim. You liberated a Jew, lokin yinavavim, but you didn't buy a slave. Did you waste your money? No, you did a mitzvah. You did pidyon shvuim. That's wonderful of you, even though you thought you were buying a slave. That mitzvah, I tell you, that kol Yisrael ifdoiso. Everyone really had to redeem, to buy this person his freedom back. Kadesh lo yitma ben agoyim, so they wouldn't assimilate. For kol shekein hu mitzvah akol Yisrael ifdoiso, the kevin shekadam zeh, you lucky owner, you lucky person who did this, who bought this slave, for kana oiso, you bought him, but actually zachar hu b'mitzvah rabbi, mitzvah rabbi, you did a wonderful mitzvah, aval ein lo din eved klav, but I've got news for you, you do not own this person, they're completely free. Okay? And then he goes on. V'afa gav de'ika sofik achrina, there's another question we need to address, shehari kol elu ha-chabashim, chabshish, from Abyssinia, hadar be'eretz kush, hey mitnagim kedat ha-karayim, but they do behave like carrots. Shehem Salakubaitis, which themselves were connected maybe with the Sadducees. Now again, the Karaites weren't connected historically with the Sadducees, but they all had the same, you know, basic issue that they didn't keep the written Torah only, the oral Torah only, the written Torah. Ve'ein anu mitzuvim loy lifdoisam aloy lechiosam. And we don't have any obligation to carrots. We owe them nothing. They are renegades. Mikol makom mistabrili. But I don't think this person is a karite. Dahani mili eilu shehen daim b'tocha rabbanim. Karites are people who live in Jewish normative rabbinic towns. V'roim divri chachamim. And they see the words of halacha. U'malidim u'maligim aleihim. And they scorn and they mock them. Al eilu v'al kliyotze behem amru moridim v'loy maralim. About them we say, we certainly don't fish them out of the river. They fall in, let them drown. We don't really care. These people, we have no obligations to these people. V'heima mishpacha rura, they are the cursed family asher kasav around them. Aval eilu abay meretz kush, but these Ethiopian Jews, hey mishevet dan b'li safek, they're not Karaites, they come from the tribe of Dan. U'mipnei sheloi hayu b'neihim chachamim, they just didn't have any rabbinic personalities. Ba'alei kabbalah, they didn't have anyone with the Talmud. Tafsu lehem pashtei aksuvim, that's why they follow the psukim, they have no other options. Aval im hayu melamdim otam, surely if you'd have taught them, they would never have rebelled like the Karaites did. So we treat these people as they didn't have access to normative Judaism, not their fault, completely Jewish, redeem them, bring them home, beautiful. But, Taina, you should know. Just before he gets on to the next one, Tzadik Ubaitis with the Bais Sheni, however, Shevet Dan Galakodim, and these people came long before the Sadducees, etc., etc. Now, however, he says, Aval, there's a little bit of a sting in the tail. The Inyan Yuchsin, but when it comes to whether you can marry them, Ani Choshish Shema Kidushim, Kidushim Vegitim, Vegitam Einun Kitikum. I'm worried that their marriages are halachic marriages, but their divorces are not halachic divorces. And therefore you can't marry them. So it's great. They're Jewish. We can rescue them. We must rescue them, he said. We can't marry them because we don't know if there are mamzerim within the group because we're worried about their divorces. Okay, that was the David ben Zimra. That was the Ravaz. That was a psak that sort of resonated through the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th century, etc., which was very clear, by the way, that they had to be rescued. No one ever disagreed on whether they had to be rescued, so they have to be rescued. Rav Herzog, once the state of Israel was set up, had another problem. Have a look with me in Rav Herzog, and then we'll see Rav Avadi Yosef. Number 12. We can read this quite quickly. It's relatively straightforward. It says number 12. Ma'id, ma'id, hitanyanti bedoch sheshalachli. Okay, I looked at this report. He had a report. He was now in the state of Israel, chief rabbi, trying to work out what to do with the Ethiopian community. There weren't that many yet coming. And he says, Tzakna yedeichem, and you should be strong. V'ta'asina, toshia, lekarev, afalashim, lemakor Yisrael. Yes, bring all these people back as soon as you can. U'mitzvah rabba la'azor ba'avodis ha'kodesh alazeh. Yes, big mitzvah to do this. B'rom yesh kan nukudah hilchatit ma'asit ma'od ma'anyenit. But there's a specific, very interesting halachic question. V'hi bekesha l'chitun, im yudim. Can they marry Jews? Again, the Radvaz's question. Are they actually descended from non-Jews? Or are they really descended from Jews? The Adarabe, im tzeitzei geirim, if they're descended from converts, zemekel, that's what's going to help them. He wants to find a way to enable these people to marry other Israeli Jews. And he says, actually, it's going to be easier if we can say they're non-Jews, or their gerim, which weren't proper converts, and then we convert them properly, and now there's no mamzerus. He says, I'm trying to do them a favor. I'm not trying to demean them. I'm not trying to say, oh, they're not Jewish. I'm trying to help them here. What he says now. Hachashashu, shema yeshnam arayat. So one question is, do they have any kind of incestuous connections? Who knows, he says, what their traditions were. Sheheim, lefi shibusheyem, mekilim ahem. And Rav Altman says, no, they didn't do that. They had very clear rules as to who they married. They didn't marry anyone who we would consider to be even in-law incestuous. Or shema yesh etzlam gerushim. Or maybe they had divorces. Vehem vaday nasim shelo kedas shel Torah. And that certainly were not halachic divorces. Therefore, I'm worried about Mamzerut. That's only if they're Jewish. If they were originally non-Jews, and then they converted, their conversions were invalid because they didn't convert to Judaism. They converted to something they thought was Judaism. Those people who converted them to Judaism thought this was Judaism, and it wasn't. It's like someone who converts today, but they make a condition, they will only keep so such and such mitzvahs, not other mitzvahs, okay? Even if it's rabbinic. And we can therefore decide maybe they weren't Jewish at all. And therefore they didn't ever get married Jewishly. And therefore we're not worried about their divorce. No problem of mamzerus. We just need to put them in the mikvah, do a conversion, and then we can marry freely with the Jewish people. Muvan, he said, it makes sense. I know. Shekol ma she'ani omer kan harari rak lichora. I'm only suggesting this, even though he's the chief rabbi and Masi Talat Chochem. Ulemasi tzarech oid iyun ubiru bedikduk chaverim ha-rabbanut ha-rashit li-Yisrael. And we need to put this to the rabbanut. Al kol panim chizku ve'insu lahavi et kulam tachat kafei ha-yadot. But for short, bring it back, bring it as soon as you can. Al ha-rabbanut ha-rashit li-Yisrael v'tziyun ve'beitchem. Fine. So Rav Herzog decided, I think they should be converted. And later that became the psak of the Rabbanut. Even though Rav Avadya Yosef, we'll see right now, disagreed with that fundamentally. Practically, not necessarily at the beginning, but fundamentally he disagreed. But the chief rabbinet, Rav Herzog, was joined by Rav Nissim, early chief rabbi, Sephardi chief rabbi, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, later on Rav Goren supported this position, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Moshe Feinstein. So that became a very mainstream position. But again, driving that was the urge to prevent any concern of Mamzerut. Okay, fine. Let's have a look at Rav Yosef. Rav Avadya Yosef, and I brought you, as always, a tiny selection from a massive tshuva. Every tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef is 30, 40 pages. I had to select from it a little bit. Let's see if we can do this a little bit. Number 30. Lachein bati lemaskana. I have come to the conclusion, he says, that the Falashim, that the Ethiopian Jews are definitely Jews and they headed south to Kush, to Ethiopia. Then comes Safek Shagainim Hanal, all of these things I listed, all these people I listed before, the Radvaz and Rav Eldad Adani, etc. Hanal, Shekavu Shehem Yishevet Dan, all these people who decided they were descended from the Ten Lost Tribes, the tribe of Dan, Chakru Vadashavi Giyu Lamaskan Azor. They clearly looked into it. Well, you don't trust them. They had evidence. They had very reliable proofs. The Kabbalah Mipi Rabbi Sayyim, and they had a tradition. This is how we work. Al Kfiyazah, they came to this halakhic conclusion. Ola Acha, Shinit Bakashti Mimin Hagea Flashim. I looked into Ethiopian Min Hagim. Asher Panu Elai. And people turned to me and asked me. They want to join the Jewish people. They want to join us. They would love to. I say to myself, this is not a time to be silent. We are absolutely obligated to save them from assimilation or tmiya, from mixing in, to hurry their aliyah. And of course we must immediately teach them our Torah, the updated rabbinic Torah. And join them in the project of Eretz Yisrael. Fine. Ulam, he said. I, of course, have read what Rav Herzog said about this, the former chief rabbi. And he wrote a letter also in 1954. Okay. Working for the Jewish agency. And I've read what he said. He doubts whether they're really Jewish. He looks to the academics, and by the way, Rav Herzog himself respected academia. He himself had a PhD in biology, in chemistry, I think he was. He was the one that looked into the Tehelet. He did a PhD in this. He valued the academy. And he said he's spoken to all these chokrim, these academics. 1 second, I've lost the place. Yeah, Manui Ugmorima Imam. And he's consulted with them and he's agreed with them. Shafalashim, hey, b'nei Gaza, lo Yehudi. That the Apalashim are descended from a non Jewish race. Shinid Gairu Apam, that somehow or other in medieval times they converted. The Imkain Heri Baruch Shalom, Nid Gairu Abinat Shishmor, it's a Yadut, and of course their conversion was invalid. A Yudut Shalanu, it's not accurate, it's not truthful. Al Pia Torot, Shadur Shabal Peh, El Yadut Shebadu Milimam. He's just repeating what Rav Herzog said. Their conversions were invalid because they're like someone who converted but didn't convert to keep all the Torah, even Divrei Rasofrim, even Rabbanan, She'ein, Mikablen, Otan. Ve'im kein shema einam yodin b'muvan hilchati, and therefore says Rav Herzog, I know he says, that they're not Jewish. L'chein yesh l'garim ha-beitin, therefore they need conversion. Beitin kosher, proper conversion. Ve'az tiyeh lahem Torah yodim gemurim. Fine. The Nord Nifleti, the last paragraph, I'm totally astounded. He pushes aside the testimony of the rabbis of the ages. These rabbis have concluded absolutely clearly. Remember, the Radvaz didn't have any doubt they were Jewish. His question was just on the Mamzei Rud, that they're definitely Jewish. He's pushed this for academics. Shemitilim Safik b'Yadutam, who have a question as to their Yadut. Mi nidcha mipnei mi. Who should be pushed in front of who? You don't push off Torah giants in front of academics from the Hebrew University. Or any university. Certainly not the Hebrew University. Okay? But he says, I've seen what the Rabbanut have decided. He said, I've seen what they do. And he brought different people together with him. I've seen the Rabbanut at least do a hatafat dam brit, because these men had brit milah. They had to do a little bit of a hatafat dam brit. He says, okay, you want to do a gil l'chumra? Okay, v'akfutzat shel afalashim she'alu atza, and at the end of the day, how many of these Ethiopians are coming? Hayumate ma'ad shel kama asrot b'kolpam. They come in their tens, twenties. It's okay, 10, 20 Ethiopians come, you do a gil l'chumra, it's nishkefelech. I don't think he would have said nishkefelech, but you know, whatever. You could do that. And these Ethiopians are only so happy to be here anyway, 10, 20 of them. They're happy to do a Geirus L'chumrah. So, Lamaisa, he said, I'm not going to go against him. I'm not going to overrule him. He was the chief rabbi. He wants to do a Geirus L'chumrah. There's only a few of them coming. They don't object. They're happy to do it. Fine. Ulam l'dina lo kein anochi imadi. But I want you to know that I fundamentally disagree with it. You can rely on the earlier authority. They don't need any conversion. Now, of course, on the back of this tshuva, not tens and twenties, but tens of thousands of Ethiopians started coming. And therefore, later, Rav Avadia, Rav Shalom talks about this. Okay, fine, the whole situation is different now. That there are tens of thousands of them coming, you're going to put them all through. There's an entire community. You're going to do a Geirus L'chumra. You don't need to, and you shouldn't. And therefore, what they did, according to Rav Shalom, is they appointed a special vad, like anyone who makes aliyah, they check out, you know, is there any specific reason why you have an issue or not have an issue with Yadut? And if there was a problem, then they dealt with the problem, just like anybody else. But they didn't require the community to do a Geirus L'chumrah. And I remember when Rav Avadi Yosef passed away, they had the shiva in Har Nof. We were living in Har Nof at the time. And obviously the shiva was like mobbed with thousands of people. Amongst them, buses and buses and buses of Ethiopian Beta Yisrael who came because Rav Avadia was their hero. A little bit like the Yemenites adopted the Rambam back in the day as their hero. So the Beta Yisrael adopted Rav Avadia. Beautiful. But 1 second. Does that mean that they're now Sephardim? He's their Rav. I mean, can you have your cake and eat it? No, Rav Avadia is my Rav, but I want to keep my Ethiopian halakhic traditions. I don't know if it works that way. If he's your Rav, he's your Rav. And next week we're going to deal with that. Can they still do the things that they used to do way back when in Ethiopia? Or are they now mainstreamed? Of course, Rav Avadia would say, there's no way these people can be Ashkenazim. Meaning, even the Ashkenazim can't be Ashkenazim. So these people, there's no way they're going to be Ashkenazim. But are they not Sephardim? And by the way, in number 14, he rejects the issue of Mamzerus completely. He said, I'm not worrying about Mamzerus. And I'll tell you why. He said, if their divorces weren't divorces, their marriages weren't marriages either. And it's not so easy just to end up halachically married. And Rav Waldman, actually, in his he has a whole essay I brought you, he picks apart the Ethiopian marriage ceremonies stage by stage and shows you how at no stage in all the things they did, and they had very elaborate ceremonies, at no stage could you call this a halachic marriage. And therefore, if you're not married, you don't need to get divorced. So he said, don't worry about it, forget about it. Fine. The Rabbanut didn't accept this, and we know that Ara Yom HaZeh there's an issue. I don't want to just finish with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein, he says here, in a number 16, in an answer to his grandson, Rav Moshe Tendler, he said, do I think these people are Jewish? And he said, no question they're Jewish. Again, they're Jewish. You can bring them over they're Jewish insofar as we have a mitzvah to rescue them, because it's Safek Nefashos. Says, and even if it's only a question, it's still a question that we have to answer on the street side, and we have to bring them over. Even if we don't even know that they're fully Jewish, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if we know that they're definitely Jewish or not Jewish, you have to bring them over. Second paragraph. Ulgabi Yadu Tamba, when it comes to their status, Nechshav Lanu B'Safik. I'm not as clear as Rabbi Vadi on this. The Eish La'atzricham Geirus Amiti. I think they need a full conversion. Before they can get married. But even before that, we have to rescue them. And then he says at the very end, that they should only have a geirus, they should only come if they have a conversion. I agree with that. But once they convert, like I've heard that some of them are doing, then of course they're Jewish. You have to support them. And I was very upset. There are some people in Eretz Israel that they don't bring them into the community. And they're lost to the Jewish people. The only reason they're doing that is because they're racists and they can't live with black Jews. It's obvious you have to bring them in. But apart from the fact that they're no worse than any other Jew. Why do I care if they're white, black, or anything? But I'll tell you something else. I think you should convert them. And now you have multiple Torah mitzvahs, not just to treat them equally, but to treat them better than every other Jew, because they're gerim. And therefore, why would there ever be somebody who doesn't treat them properly? He leaves it with that. But he does require a conversion. And I just brought you at the end, the last pasuk, I'm not going to read it through now. Yeshaya talks about the Jews coming from Kush. There's very much an enormous kibbutz galiot of the Ethiopian Jews coming in. So we've looked today at the issue of status. We haven't resolved it entirely. Depends on who you ask, the Rabbanut or Rabbi Vadia. Next week we look at the halachic questions as to how we deal with some of their practices. Fascinating issues. Till next week, Be'ezrat Hashem.